Blog Talk Radio.
Our blessings and greetings and blessings, blessed souls. We're alive because we want to stay alive in Torah Chaim, instructions of life, Torah Chesed, instructions of kindness, Torah Rachim, instructions of mercies. We're now tuned into blogtalkradio.com, and we humbly suggest we the higher inner frequency. We are called ourselves Soul Class. This is Soul Class 553, secular by design. Program presentation number 54. We've rebooted our membership to Blog Talk Radio, and blesses our Creator, Baruch Hashem, Shalom, peace, and bracha, blessings upon the human family experience. Our next program is right now with Creator's help at 10:32 here on February 3rd, 2016, live from Turtle Island, a.k.a. the USA, Unified Soul Actualization. The content to be discussed will be reading from Alan W. Cecil's seminal work, Secular by Design, A Philosophy of Noahide Laws and Observances. Don't be shy and give the program a try by calling in to listen at 347-838-8669 or express your views and cause other souls to glisten. Meanwhile, may the Eternal Creator bless and protect you and your loved ones. P.S. You can also purchase Alan's books by going to anywhere on the net. Just type in Secular by Design, A Philosophy of Noahide Laws and Observances, and just type in the author's name, Alan W. Cecil, that's C-E-C-I-L. In order to start the program, we've got to turn down the music. Originally, we usually start our music, our programs, with our introductory segue music by Brother in Song, Spirit, and Prayer, Isaac Batone. But before the program, there were a lot of glitches and Murphy Laws, and also there was a medical incident with my father. We'll talk about that in 1 minute. Let's just turn down the music for Instead of Your Fears by David Dolman, get right on with the shoe. Okay, and before we do that, let's just bring in quickly our co-host. We have, of course, author and human being extraordinaire with a lot of savoir-faire, who I know he cares, Alan Cecil. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, and I'm glad you didn't ask me to sing since you were out of music, because we would have driven away all the listeners.
Okay. And also we have Rambam teacher, student, and disseminator of the teachings of Rambam, of Moshe Ben Maimon, Hanesha Gubel, the great eagle. Good morning, sir. Dennis Ryan.
Good morning, Don. Good morning, Alan. And I'm not going to sing, but I can hum.
Well, you could sing. You might not be able to sing, but you could hum. But if we all started a trio, they'd probably call us the bums. Anyway, I'd like to start the program very quickly with a comment you actually made, Alan, on a little snippet that was taken off the net about a quote from the Rebbe, and how your book is not a contradiction to this following piece of wisdom from the Lubavitcher Rebbe. It's called Tikkun Olam, the repair of the world. If you see what needs to be repaired and how to repair it, then you have found the piece of the world that God has left for you to complete. But if you only see what is wrong and what is ugly in the world, then it is you yourself that needs repair. And that's a quote from the Rebbe, or perhaps it's a paraphrasing. And you mentioned that that our system, let me just read your quote here, and I want to respond to that. Of course, I want to get your reaction. Unfortunately, what I saw was that most of our legal system is what needs repairing. Now, that's not a problem. That doesn't mean because the legal system needs repairing that you need repair. If you're looking it through the stethoscope or microscope or the MRI of Torah teachings as it relates to the seven Noahide commandments, or I as a Jew through the 613 commandments, yeah, we have to call out matters that need addressing. I think the Rebbe was really addressing more the idea of just looking out into the world without any context about which to judge the world, but just going on one's own, you know, human perception and saying there's something wrong without having any basis for what that wrong is about. But when you have something along the lines of Torah, whether it be the seven Noahide commandments or the 613 commandments, you have the basis of making a public statement or a private statement, or as you did write your wonderful book, Secular Design, to saying, guys, there has to, and ladies and gentlemen, we have to make a change in the world. Any take on that, Alan?
The Rebbe talked about the systems of government need to be in line with the Noahide laws, and I totally agree with that. With his view from that perspective was a lot like other rabbis, like Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch, and I totally agree with that. That's really what needs fixing. You know, we have to put our legal system, what we call our secular legal system, secular government, has to be in line with the Noahide law.
Right. Dennis, any take on these matters?
Yes. There's right and there's wrong, and there's humans going along doing rationalizations. We've somehow created rationalizations that are so far from right and wrong that we're creating a different world so that more of our opinions and rationalizations mean more than the original principles that we used to distinguish between right and wrong.
True. That being said, we're going to segue back into page 105, which this part of Alan's book is on the beginning of this section. Actually, the larger section is called The Protocols of the Historian. So I guess the subsection that Alan put this subsection title is All Roads Lead from Rome. I want to quote from Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch, which Alan did in his book, that the Jews were destined to be the eternal people of history, to wander the earth as the quote-unquote eternal Jew, to stand at the cradle and grave of all nations, to undergo the evolutions and revolutions in history, to suffer in the catastrophes of nations. From the shipwreck of the past, we were assigned the task of successfully savaging the eternal spiritual heritage of all mankind. From the onset of history, we were given stern notice, meaning we as the Jewish people, to send this message out to mankind. Do not be dazzled by material might, no matter how brilliantly and meteorically it beckons on the historical firmament of nations. Do not tremble when sword-carrying nations subdue and brutalize the defenseless. Unfortunately, we see this going on right now in the Middle East and Africa and other parts of the world. Always be aware that the days of any power are numbered which fails to accept the certainty of the ultimate victory of men's spiritual and moral destiny. So this, to me, puts a sort of like an umbrella type of consciousness for us to be protected from the travails and the constant pounding of horrible news that's going on. I mean, I just saw on the internet briefly there was a couple of stabbings and there was some terrorists who wanted to try to machine gun down a bunch of Jews, and there might have been Bnei Noach in that area too, in Jerusalem. So how do we make sense of it? I don't, at this particular moment, I can't. It's just it's painful to share it with your blessed souls, but the point is, Rabbi Samson Hirsch, an honest to good and an authentic Torah scholar, wants us to know from the 19th century and onward that the days of any power are numbered which fail to accept the certainty of the ultimate victory of man's spiritual and moral destiny, which is what the 7 Noahic commandments and in the larger scope the 613 for us in the nation of Israel, when we go back to the land of Israel, will be enjoined to work upon and implement within our space and creation. Alan, any take on these matters?
You know, you would think that after 4,000 years, mankind would get a clue that their man-made governments and legal systems haven't worked very well. We haven't devised a system where we can treat each other fairly and live in peace. And things seem to be getting worse instead of better. And, you know, to me, it's like, why can't we give this system a try?
Amen. Dennis, any take on these matters?
Yes, everything on this planet is temporary. And when people finally understand that, maybe they'll change their thinking to adjust to what is permanent. But while they're busy rationalizing the temporary world we live in and how important it is minuscule compared to the permanent way of life of God's world. So we have to put this in perspective so people understand. Just like we had the Jews had a Babylonian captivity and an Egyptian captivity. Did that stop them? Did that change anything? Did they learn anything from that? But everything is temporary. So we cannot build on temporary thoughts.
Okay. Let's go into the book. We need to do a little further backdrop. This part of the section of Alan's book, he is dissecting the thinking process, the rationalizations of one writer, Edward Gibbon, who wrote a book, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, which was first published in the late 18th century and considered one of the greatest histories ever penned. Now, we read this on the last time we did this program, which was way back at the beginning of December, but I think it's important how to put, you know, because as I read further after this brief backup at the top of the page of 105 to give us a little more context with which to understand what he said and how Alan is looking it through the eyes of the 7 Noahide commandments. So, Gibbon describes Jews and Judaism from the perspective of Christian theology, using theological terminology and concepts such as his comments on the early Jewish church. And this is taking from page 594 to 595 from The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. Here we go. Beside the general design of fixing on a perpetual basis the divine honors of Christ, the most ancient and respectable of the ecclesiastical writers have ascribed to the evangelic theologian a particular intention to confute two opposite heresies which disturb the peace of the primitive church. The faith of the Ebionites, perhaps of the Nazarenes, was gross and imperfect. They revered Jesus as the greatest of the prophets, endowed with this supernatural virtue and power, but they obstinately rejected the preceding existence and divine perfections of the Logos, or Son of God, which are so clearly defined in the Gospel of St. John. Now, before I go to Alan and Dennis for commentary, I just want to point out that as a Jew, I kind of cringe where Gibbon is ascribing to those Ebionites or Nazarenes as revering Jesus as the greatest of the prophets and cutting and pasting that to the understanding that I've heard from many Christians that without the Old Testament, the New Testament has nothing to stand upon. Yet, in the Old Testament, it says there never rose up a prophet like Moses. So why either Gibbon is imposing that viewpoint and couching it in the language that's what the Nazarenes or Ebionites thought of their Messiah, or they actually felt that, which again, for me, again, not to get into, I'm not trying to attack Christianity, but just I want anyone out there who is a Ben Noah or a full-fledged Christian to understand that this is one of the reasons why we as a Jewish people cannot accept the New Testament as our testament, because it flies in the face of what Moses was told by God. Not that Moses came up with his own ideology, theology, philosophy. He as a prophet of God, he was told to write that there will never rise up another prophet like him again. There would be other prophets, but at his level of prophecy, I'm sorry, blessed souls, I don't know if this disappoints other people, it makes people a little more sober in their appreciation of the five books of Moses. He is, according to the Torah of Israel, which is what God gave to us, there has never risen a prophet to the level of prophecy again as the likes of Moses. Alan?
And, you know, one of the things that's just so strange about that quote is that the Ebionites were the original Jewish church. They were what James, Peter, these were the direct followers of the original Hebrew church. The power shift came after the destruction of the temple when the church kind of fell into more Gentile hands. But it just shows Gibbon's bias against Judaism. Even though I don't know how religious he was personally, just the whole academic bias against anything Jewish really shines, you know, it's very apparent in his writing.
Which, before I turn to Dennis, which meant if from the, you know, who was it? There was a rabbi from Raka Yaakov Emden asserts that Jesus or Yeshua was actually an observant Jew. So if Gibbon is coming to attack the Judaism of the Christian Messiah, he's actually going against the Christian Messiah. So again, here's another paradox.
He's attacking Jesus' religion and all the apostles' religion because they were all observant Jews.
See, he would go up against all of them. Okay. Dennis, your take on these matters.
Well, I happen to agree with both of you gentlemen, slightly for a different reason. Yes, I cringe like you cringe, Don, because there's distortion and people got the sequence a whack here. There'd be no Christianity if there was no Judaism. And people somehow say, oh, well, it all began with... No, it didn't begin with. It began with the beginning of time. Not all of a sudden, some part in history, things began. No. So I think this distortion has grown to the point that where this historian comes through, Gibbons, and he has his own opinion... He's now placing things in sequences that he wants the reader to understand. Why? Mm-hmm. That's still his opinion. So I don't know if you want to call his book one of the greatest this or that, but we cannot keep distorting things because it's very hard to get back to the simple facts. And this is where we come to these rationalizations, when it's very clear. I mean, Moses got the tablets, and on the tablets was what is right and what is wrong. We don't need further explanations or rationalizations of that. That came directly from the finger of the Almighty. Period.
True. So let's go further on as so did Alan on this brief quote from Gibbon, Edward Gibbon, from his book, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. And Alan continued to write, from the Noahide perspective, there are several problems with Gibbon's statement. First of all, Gibbon pointed out the theology of the Ebionites and the Nazarenes was heretical. The Ebionites were, in fact, quote-unquote, the primitive church, the original church which all later Christian sects, SECTS, were directly descended from. The first and original Jewish church that was based in Jerusalem, the church led by James and Peter. Gibbon himself pointed out the Jewish ties to the original Jewish church. Alan quotes from the book, the Ebionites, or the statement by Gibbon, the Ebionites, or at least the Nazarenes, were distinguished only by their obstinate perseverance in the practice of the Mosaic rites, the insufficient creed of the Nazarenes and the Ebionites. The original Jewish church's creed was insufficient because it did not contain the elements that were later developed by the Hellenistic Pauline sects, SECTS, such as the Trinity, the quote-unquote the virgin birth, and the quote-unquote incarnation. This is what made the Ebionites and Nazarenes gross and imperfect. They did not agree with the theology of the later developed Catholic Church. Gibbon ridicules the Ebionites and Nazarenes for obstinately rejecting the preceding existence and divine perfections of the Logos, or Son of God, which are so clearly defined in the Gospel of St. John. According to the early church fathers, these early Jewish sects, SECTS, used a Hebrew manuscript of Matthew. Matthew, of course, is the quote-unquote most Jewish of the four Gospels of the New Testament. And if these early Jewish Christians had a Hebrew version, there's good reason to believe that was the original version. Why would the Jewish Christians, in possession of the original Matthew, with its teachings in Jesus' native tongue, cast it aside for the latter written, more Gnostic-flavored Greek version of John? Gibbon could be excused in that he wrote his history in the late 18th century, when biblical textual criticism was in its infancy, and that he didn't have the benefit of modern scholarship on the early Greek manuscripts of the New Testament. And yet, Alan, here he was, you know, praised, and, you know, he was probably at the in the upper echelon cocktail parties and societal gatherings being praised for his great work, when it's so distorted and full of lack of authentic scholarship of the history of the fall of the rise and the fall of the Roman Empire as related to the, probably the Romans looked at it as the Jewish problem. Any take on this?
Well, Gibbon was an expert on Roman history. He obviously did not know anything about Jewish history other than what he might have picked up in church, which of course would be very slanted. And this is the problem, not just of Gibbon, but of so many people.
Ron? Dennis?
Yes, well, a lot of people have a hard time accepting the facts. Why? Because sometimes somebody's opinion sounds better than the facts, or they want to believe in something that someone else believes in. So we have these historians who have contributed to human understanding, but they do it from a different perspective. In other words, they do it from a retrospective viewpoint. They'll take something that happened way back in time and sort of recreate it so it fits in their latest thinking. Well, we don't need their latest thinking when the old thinking worked and nothing has changed to change the old thinking. But yet, people think they have to go and rationalize and create things. So we constantly have this state of distortion, and it comes and goes. And some people, depending on what is chick, will believe in this book that was written, this history that was viewed by someone who had a slanted view of things. It goes on and on. We fill up libraries with these things, too. But that doesn't mean that we don't follow what is right and wrong and the tablets that God wrote with his finger.
Thank you, Dennis. Okay, going further, now on page 106 in Alan's Secular by Design, we're in the section called The Protocols of the Historian. But modern scholarship has done little to change the mainstream perception of Gibbon's point of view. There was a pattern that developed among historians. They chose the facts that suited their view of Judaism, the view of the church, the viewpoint of Western Greco-Roman civilization. Oscar Spengler wrote, as Alan quoted him from Spengler's The Decline of the West, page 205, "The Jews are a particular phenomenon in world history only as so long as we insist on treating them as such." And this, Spengler, as Alan points out, was a product of the German historical school in the early 20th century. Describing the tasks of the Western historian is an attempt actually to prove that the Jewish people are really not all that special. Their miraculous survival throughout the ages was simply an historical fluke. To portray the Jewish people as simply another group of people whose longevity was an oddity regulated to the status of the historical footnote was integral to a methodological system of denial that was applicable to the academic disciplines. And this can be seen in Gibbon's incisive disdain of the Jews, which pervaded his historical point of view. And this is quoting from Gibbon's The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, pages 348 and 349. A single people refused to join in the common intercourse of mankind. The Jews, who under the Assyrian and Persian monarchies had languished for many ages the most despised portion of their slaves, emerged from obscurity under the successors of Alexander. The sullen obstinacy which they maintained their peculiar rights and unsocial manners seemed to mark them out as a distinct species of men who boldly professed, who faintly disguised their implacable hatred to the rest of humankind. Neither the violence of Antiochus, nor the acts of Herod, nor the example of the circumjacent nations could ever persuade the Jews to associate the institutions of Moses, the elegant mythology of the Greeks. Now, I want to comment at this point very quickly that, first of all, I take great exception to the idea that he is portraying us as having an implacable hatred to the rest of humankind. Now, I will admit I have heard on an individual basis individuals spew hatred as Jewish people towards other people, not of our nation. Some of it because they are Holocaust survivors or the children or grandchildren of Holocaust survivors. Some of them because they are distorted, and some of them because they're mentally ill. And some of them because they're just very uneducated and have to upgrade their consciousness. But I just want to point out, Blessed Souls, that if we have, quote-unquote, this implacable hatred, the source for it is not justified in the Torah, but there's a wariness that we have as a nation when it comes to our relationship with God and the Torah that he's given to us by virtue of the fact that we went out of Egypt. We had gained the grace of the Egyptians because they saw the hand of God. And most notably, Paro, who was not a simpleton. He was not a fool. He was a wise man who unfortunately, as Rambam speaks about very openly in his 8 chapters to his Mishnah Torah, Shmona Prochem the Mishnah, that he basically lost his free will because his heart was hardened because he let us deal wisely with this nation. And then he came up with the subsequent schemes of skullduggery to drown the boys because the astrologers of Egypt said deliver a redeemer of Israel. He's going to be born within this nation. And then, okay, the 10 plagues happened. We left with the splitting of the Red Sea. And lo and behold, a nation called Amalek came, which came with just one intent, absolute hatred and difference towards the role of the Israelites, and they had not even received formally the Ten Commandments. So Amalek is a type of attitude, blessed souls, that we Jews have encountered. Anything that will try to make us have doubts about what's written in the Torah, the written in all Torah traditions, we take a step back and saying, what is the motivation that someone who is not of our nations can try to tell us what our traditions are? Just as I am very hesitant to say someone born here who is a native-born American, although even though it would seem from an outward outsider's glance that some of their traditions are not according to the Noahic commandments, I'm not there to tell them to stop doing it as much as to tell them they can integrate these systems of Noahic commandments or with an American society or within any society I may be living in. I'm living in the West here in America. So I just want people to understand there can be that hatred, but to ascribe it as Gibbon did was probably something which would, you know, and that would fuel future anti-Semitism, which was, of course, the fuel to the fire of the antecedents which led up to the Holocaust. And to this day, you know, when I hear these writings, I wonder how much of that philosophy spawned over into the minds of imams or muftis or Islamic leaders who then inject this type of poison into their, you know, devoted masses of followers that creates further hatred towards us and then blaming on us that we have some sort of implacable hatred toward the rest of mankind. Alan, your take on these matters and why I'm so upset about what Gibbon stated.
Yeah, well, the poison of Amalek has filtered through Western society, and it's infected a great part of the world, unfortunately. And remember, Amalek was a descendant of Esau, and this is, mm-hmm. you know, we're living in an Asuvian-based civilization, so that poison is rampant among many of the nations, especially in the West. I mean, you know, you see it, what's going on in the Middle East, you see so many of the, a lot of people here in America and Europe who, despite, you know, despite the fact that, you know, the Jews are not out there blowing up restaurants, doing honor killings, you know, things of that nature, you know, slaughtering women and children, burning them alive. I don't know if you saw that story that the Muslim group, the Boko Haram in Africa, burned, what was it, 80 children to death?
Yeah, yeah.
Just the other day. And, you know, how can they, but yet, even though in the face of all these atrocities, they sit there, they still have that attitude, oh, the Jews hate everybody.
True. And but let's point out, too, Alan, before we turn to Dennis for feedback, we have to give credit where credit's due. We don't see this on the part of the Christian communities, the Hindu communities, and also, in large in part, for the vast majority of Muslim Americans or, you know, and everywhere they are, you know, most of them still do not want to take up arms with ISIS or whatever type of ideology, which can only be described as apocalyptic and chaotic, reversing the world to day two of the creation, where the world was dark and full of void and astonishingly empty. So, you know, it's that group of ideological bad apples that is really casting aspersions, really, and as Rabbi Shmuley Bateik says, is they're contributing to the annihilation of their own faith by using it for their own evil. Dennis?
Well, going back to the beginning of the program, you commented on how Alan said, well, we gotta regenerate our justice or legal system because governments sometimes are out of alignment with people. Well, we have a group of people who say, yeah, Sharia law will do that. Well, do we want to go to that extreme? Can we fix our own problems? Or do we have to borrow something that is barbaric and absolute that even if you criticize it, you're blaspheming? So we have to have something that's livable. And yet, we have people that believe that the academic world has been dumping on Jews forever because they say they're different, they're hateful, they're this, they're that. It almost sounds like they're bad people, but they're not using the word bad. Why? Because is there a difference between right and wrong, an old right and wrong, and a new right and wrong? Did Christianity create a new right and wrong? Does Judaism hangs on to an old right and wrong? Well, I submit that there's only one right and wrong. There is no new or old. But a lot of people in their rationalization and looking at things want to say, well, we got to get rid of this old stuff. Why? There's no problem. We must remember when Jesus of Nazareth was walking on the planet, he was quoting the Bible and the sages. He did not invent anything. He used everything that was existing. And he preached love and peace, which seems to be a human problem in all annals of history. Peace and love? Who's practicing that when we have to refigure things and impose certain things when it's already been established? So how far from the old are we when we say we're doing it the new way?
Okay, gentlemen, thank you, Dennis. And we're going to wrap it up right now. I'd like to thank Alan and Dennis and Alan, for taking and using one of the most valuable resources, their blessed time here on the planet Earth, to dialogue with myself as we have now rebooted our efforts to hopefully restore our weekly presentation of Secular by Design, a philosophy of Noahide laws and observances, something I enjoy doing immensely. And we're going to. So before we segue to our program-ending music, Alan, any last bit of advice or viewpoint you'd like to share with our blessed listening audience?
Not really.
Okay.
Don't have anything to say except just study more.
And I'll tap into Alan's consciousness. Please buy the book. You won't be sorry you did. Dennis, anything else you'd like to add before we close out the program?
Yes. Trust in God. He's our best friend.
Thank you. Okay, blessed. We're going to segue out with Isaac Piton's song, We Will Live Forever, which I think connects very nicely to the statement of Rabbi Shamshon Raphael Hirsch's statement in his collective writings. Let me read it one more time. Always be aware that the days of any power are numbered which fails to accept the certainty of the ultimate victory of men's spiritual and moral destiny, and may this all be accomplished and actualized in a way of ahavachad, one love, gorlachad, one destiny, kolonah for all of us, badachin amdachi shalom, in a peaceful and pleasant way. And just remember, you've got to be good, blessed souls. Why do you have to be good, even though that might generate ambivalence and paradoxes and contradictions within yourself? Because the teva tov lehetiv, it's the nature of the good to do good, and the Creator is the source of all goodness, including the goodness within yourself. So go ahead and tap into it, and let's all, as Isaac Piton sings it to us right now from his Rei Mehemna Songs for Brother Volume 2, which was a musical effort dedicated to his brother who was unfortunately killed in an Israeli army event in the Middle East. So let's go back to We Will Live Forever by Isaac Piton. Blessed Hashem, God willing, hopefully tomorrow we will continue with our efforts on Blog Talk Radio, to be announced as after I program the next installment for tomorrow, God willing. Take care, everyone.
Deep sea.